The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated.
This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. The State Farm Fire and Casualty Company versus Julie Kathleen Gandy from Harrison County. Bonham State Bank versus Raymond G. Beadle, individually and doing business as the Blue Max, Blue Max and Blue Max Inc., RGB Investments Inc., Blue Max Inc., and Blue Max Racing Inc. from Fannin County. Selma Reinhart and Sally Treen versus William Carl Young from Fort Bend County. And AT&T Consultants, Inc. versus John Sharp, Controller, on original mandamus proceeding. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. The relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments, but we will conclude all the arguments before we take our lunch break. The arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience, and you may listen to a tape of the arguments by so requesting the clerk of our court. The court is ready to hear from petitioner in State Farm versus Gandy.
May I please report? This is Michael Huddleston. Michael Huddleston presents argument to petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. When one looks at the record of this case, I believe that anyone would conclude that the covenant and assignment rules as they presently exist and are being applied in the courts in this state, particularly as applied in this case, need restatement and revision. One finds that this is not a case of an insurance company refusing to act for its insured. It is a case where the insurance company did more than it had to. State Farm offered to pay the fees of its insured's personally selected counsel. We know that State Farm had no obligation to defend as found by the trial court, and that they had no duty to indemnify for the horrible acts committed by Ted Pierce on Julie Gandy. But it is, though, through this insurance system, this covenant fiction, that State Farm is being told and the insurance companies in this state are being told, you must pay for harm where we know there is none. You must pay for the damages and stigma of a crime that you did not commit. And those who are most guilty, the attorney who committed the malpractice, and most importantly, the molester who is convicted of a crime, who pled to a crime of molestation, goes free without paying one red cent. Texas justice, we believe, promises more than this. Due process, we believe, requires more than this. The case presents two issues: legal sufficiency as to damages and the liability findings, legal sufficiency on DTPA and negligence. My turn to the first issue. This court, of course, issued Garcia 1, in which it found that covenants not to execute did not eliminate damages. That case has been vacated. It came out the day before the Court of Appeals opinion in our case was issued, but the court did not know of it. We filed a motion for rehearing, which raised this issue to the court's attention, but the court, in its second opinion in our case, found that it still felt somehow compelled to follow Garcia 1. We believe that Garcia 1 does not control this case and should not be the law in this state. We also believe, though, and it's very important from the outset to understand that even assuming that Garcia 1 applies in this case, as a general principle, when we look at the facts, it does not apply from a legal standpoint. And that is for two reasons. There is no coverage in this case, and it is not a Stowers case. Every case that has applied the covenant fiction has been a case where those two principles apply, where those two facts were established, coverage and a Stauer situation. That's the narrow public policy exception to what has been the general rule in this state for literally hundreds of years, and that is that a covenant not to execute is, at law, the legal equivalent of a release. There is language in one of the cases cited by the court in Garcia 1 that is just simply incorrect. It cites an out-of-state case for the principle that a covenant is not a release. We know from the Texas authority, Panhandle versus Wilson, as restated in the Mercer v. Woods case, that a covenant to avoid circuity of action is treated as the legal equivalent of a release and is discharged. Now, in Texas, we have recognized a limited exception in some instances. Some courts have suggested that there is an exception based on public policy where there is coverage and the insurance company has refused to defend or refused to settle the case.
Even where there is no coverage, frequently insurance companies, until they determine that there's no coverage, will defend under a reservation of rights. And so are you advocating a rule that would exonerate an insurance company from any liability for acts committed during the course of a defense of a case under a reservation of rights when there ultimately is determined to be no coverage?
No, Your Honor, that's not the instance in this case, though. And certainly we don't have to even get to that position, because in this case, State Farm merely offered to pay fees. It did not get itself involved in actually doing the defense. We were like a good Samaritan who extended our hand to try to help, and we were told basically, just bug off, go away. In fact, in the words of Mr. Andrews, the attorney for Mr. Pierce, he treated our offer to pay fees as just simply something to throw in the wastebasket. And so that's where our offer went. Garcia 1 focuses on the public policy of taking an insured who has coverage, looking out after the interests of that insured. That's where the public policy behind even the states that have recognized it flows. And in this case, where there is no coverage, there is no need for deterrence of an insurance company. There is no need for a hammer to force them to look out after the interests of the insured, because the insured has no interest where there is no coverage. And also, we look at the Stauer setting as being the one, we look at the Iowa law as one of the examples of the court that has recognized this principle. Stauer's is the narrow area where this rule has been recognized. It has not been expanded into other areas. This is not a Stauer's case.
So you say, I understand you say in response to my question, that is not this case, and you don't need to get there, but what, assuming we make some statement in that regard, would you contend that the insurance company has no obligation to a person who it chooses to defend under reservation of rights until it determines whether, in fact, coverage does not exist?
Well, if, for example, legal malpractice was committed by the defense lawyer in the course, and it was a defense lawyer selected by the insurance company, so that under Ranger versus Gwynn, we would have the argument the insurance company could be held responsible. In that setting, certainly, that would be the case, even though there was no coverage, because of the mere fact that at the very least there was in fact an assumption of responsibility. Again, in this case, the assumption was an offer to pay fees, which was rejected soundly. Now, the public policy issue that comes in this case, we want to make clear, and we tried to do that in the recent reply brief that we filed. There's a question about terminology. Simply this: we begin with the principle that a covenant is a discharge. It is the respondents in this case who have to urge a public policy exception to that rule to avoid the fact that the covenant negates damages. And in this case, we believe that that public policy balance falls heavily in favor of giving the covenant its full effect and discharging the damages in this case. Now, the particular public policy issues, I think we'll find after review, mirror very much public policy concerns expressed in Elbor, reflected in the Beach versus Jenkins case, and several other cases in which this court, we believe, has begun a trend to try to bring some reason to the deal cutting that is going on in this state that is reflected in numerous decisions involving Mary Carter agreements, involving suits between co-defendants, This type of machination is being discouraged by this court, and we believe that this case and this particular part of the law in Texas is the next logical step to bring reason and integrity to our judicial system. First public policy question that is a concern in this case. Stowers begins with the principle that compensation is for harm resulting from the judgment. Harm resulting from the judgment, not the judgment itself. The compensation principle requires real harm. The covenant fiction would violate that public policy. Second policy. This, in effect, by arguing that the judgment is funded by the bad faith case, would result in a violation of the prohibition both from a common law standpoint and from a statutory standpoint, direct actions, because we know that they're achieving indirectly what you can't achieve directly. And I think if the court will look at the Beach versus Jenkins line of cases, that is the approach that has ultimately been taken, for example, in the Security versus INA case, where they tried to extend it to a Stowers assignment.
Even if we were to agree with you that the covenant negates damages in the terms of the underlying judgment, the Court of Appeals here held that there was evidence of damage to Pierce's reputation, credit, and ability to conduct his business, and that was an alternative basis upon which its judgment was rendered. What's your response to that contention?
Well, we're very happy to respond to that, although we have been accused of hiding from it. Frankly, the only people that ought to hide from this, frankly, are the criminals who are trying to get benefit from this rule, because what we have is State Farm is not only being held responsible for something with respect to which it had no coverage, it had no duty to defend, but now, because of this opinion, is paying for the stigma that a criminal suffered. Your Honor.
That wasn't my question. My question was, assuming you're right and that a covenant negates any harm in terms of the damage of the underlying judgment, here the Court of Appeals held there was an alternative basis for the judgment, and that is the evidence of damage to Pierce's reputation, credit, and ability to conduct his business. Why doesn't that support the Court of Appeals judgment, even if you're right on the covenant?
All right, but what the court has to look to is what the Court of Appeals used as evidence to reach that conclusion. And the evidence that they directed us to was the evidence of stigma in terms of Mr. Pierce and his reputation and his ability to do business being damaged by the fact that he had this molestation charge against him. I mean, if the court looks at the testimony that was recited in the Court of Appeals, and it's in the briefs, it is solely directed to those criminal problems. He had to register with the DEA, with local authorities. He had to register with the FBI for being a sex offender. Now, that's not something that State Farm caused. There's nothing that State Farm did that can even be remotely tied to that from a causation standpoint. It's just simply something Ted Pierce did to himself when he committed these crimes. And that goes to the other, it blends into the other issue, because when we step back to public policy, if the court will direct its attention to number 6 of this public policy argument, is that the most guilty parties go free under this system. Ted Pierce committed a crime. And in the recent decision of Sachs versus Sawtell Good, the court stated the basic policy is that an individual who has committed illegal acts should not be permitted to profit financially or otherwise be indemnified from their crimes. They noted a Dallas case, Peeler versus Hughes, which stated that punishment for crime is intended to be personal and absolute, and to accomplish the prevention of crime, which is the purpose of punishment, it is quite necessary that the person should not even entertain the hope of indemnity for the offense committed.
Let me ask you a quick question. The Court of Appeals opinion indicates that Pierce testified he could have won the civil suit. I think there's a preservation of error point on that. What was done in the trial court, if anything, to preserve any objection to that testimony or any error in admitting that kind of testimony? Was there any objection to the trial court?
There was no objection to his response, and it was, probably should have been objected to in terms of non-responsiveness, but frankly that was part of the point we were making to the jury, is the absurdity of a party coming in and taking two positions, because Ms. Gandy's in the position of saying he did it, but yet in the trial court, through her attorneys and through this assignment mechanism, she's taking the position in front of the jury that she's entitled to recover because of the fact that Ted didn't do it and because he could have won the trial. their own expert. For example, Mr. McMahon testified that he wasn't going to win the trial, that he had almost no hope of doing that. And in fact, Mr. Pierce himself, under Anderson versus Snyder decision of this court, a lay witness is not capable of giving what is, in effect, a legal opinion.
Is there any preservation of error at that point in the trial?
There was no objection to that testimony, but there doesn't have to be, Your Honor, because under Anderson versus Snyder, the court said that that type of conclusory statement based upon, or rather coming from, someone who is not qualified to testify as a lawyer is no evidence.
That was a summary judgment case, counsel.
That is correct, and that also under the case law of this state says that
The rules are different in summary judgment cases.
No, Your Honor. They are not in terms of, because you're looking at legal
sufficiency. Conclusory statements will not support a summary judgment, will they?
Because they are not evidence, and you don't have to object to them to be able to review it, and that was the principle.
But you're saying the rule's the same in a jury trial, that a conclusory statement by a witness is no evidence, absent an objection?
That is correct, Your Honor. In fact, that was recently held in Merrill Dow versus Havner by the Houston Court of Appeals, where a plaintiff's expert was allowed to testify extensively that Bendectin caused birth defects, and the court held that even though it came in, it was a question of legal sufficiency. And those statements were not evidence of probative value, and the court looked at it after the fact, not requiring an objection to the testimony. And again, what Ted Pierce said, does it have probative value? No. And in fact, it is completely contradicted as a matter of law by the fact that the court found that he was not entitled to indemnity, which required the finding that he in fact did these acts. Also in this case, judicial estoppel, we believe, would bar the plaintiff from taking contradictory positions in this case. There is, and going back to the public policy, if I may briefly conclude, answer your question, there is a rule of disciplinary conduct that says that we will not permit a lawyer to come into court knowing that a witness is going to tell an untruth and allow him to take the stand and do it. And if they do, it should be withdrawn. That testimony has not been withdrawn in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Palmer.
At the court, Mr. Carl Adams, will present argument for response.
May it please the court, I'm Carl Adams from Dallas, and I'm proud to represent Julie Gandy here today, the plaintiff in the trial court and the prevailing party in the Court of Appeals. I will present argument on three areas. The first is the area of what I'm going to say is a claim that State Farm enjoys immunity in this case. The second is that the DTPA should and does cover the kind of confusion that State Farm created for Mr. Pierce in this case. And lastly, that State Farm is attempting to argue to you a point of voidness for public policy reasons that while it raised in the trial court, it did not brief and it did not have a point of error on in any stage of the Court of Appeals briefing or in its application to this court.
Mr. Adams, I understand the order you want to do it in. I'm interested in the confusion part of this. What is it that State Farm did that it should not have done, or what did it fail to do that it should have done to avoid confusion?
The evidence showed that there were three letters sent to Mr. Pierce and some oral conversations to Mr. Pierce wherein State Farm represented to Pierce that State Farm would defend him. When those letters got to trial, State Farm's own testimony was, we never intended to defend Pierce. We intended to set up a defense, an independent defense, where Pierce would defend himself, and he would be in plenary control of the executive powers over his defense.
There are three letters. Now, Mr. Pierce said that he had no conversations with his attorney, Mr. Andrews, about State Farm paying his fees. He had no, I'm a little bit curious how these three letters created confusion for Mr. Pierce. Was he expecting State Farm to have a lawyer contact him, or was he expecting a lawyer to kind of show up in the courtroom at some point?
Well, Pierce is not exactly clear in his testimony of what his anticipations were, but Pierce says he understood that State Farm was going to undertake to defend him. And when he found out that they were merely going to pay Andrews fees, he was upset by that and attempted to call them to tell them that Andrews was not the guy to defend the case, was a criminal lawyer and could not, in his opinion, perform. And ultimately, he proved to be right.
So the entire evidence of confusion is the letters from State Farm saying that they agreed to defend him under reservation of rights.
In principle, yes. That's the main part of it. The oral conversations that they told Pierce they would defend him. See, what it comes down to is the letters and the representations are, Mr. Pierce, we, State Farm, will defend you. Pierce understood from that that State Farm was making all the calls about who the lawyer would be and how the lawyer would send bills and that they would control the defense. In his attempts to contact State Farm to inform them that this was not going well, that the lawyer wasn't returning his calls, he testified he couldn't get any relief. At time of trial, they come in and say, these letters didn't mean that, Mr. Pierce. These letters meant you were defending yourself. And I would argue to this court that it's no small thing, the determination of who's in the executive control of the case. Mr. Pierce believed, and believed honestly, that he was not in control of the case, and that's all the reason why he was calling State Farm to get some help.
What in the record demonstrates any conversations Mr. Andrews had with the insurance company about who was going to defend Mr. Pierce?
Mr. Andrews never contacted the insurance company and never acted on any of the letters that we've been able to see to accept the defense or to act as their agent, if
what,
you will.
What in the record demonstrates how State Farm found out about Mr. Andrews? If Mr. Andrews had no contact with State Farm, how did State Farm have contact with Mr. Andrews?
The representative for State Farm, the investigator, conducted an investigation and a statement from Mr. Pierce in Mr. Andrews' office back before it made the determination to provide a defense. So they knew full well who Mr. Andrews was.
So Mr. Pierce told State Farm that he'd hired Mr. Andrews to represent him in the criminal charges.
Well, they had the meeting in Mr. Andrews' office. I don't know there's no evidence that he told State Farm that Andrews had been hired or anything else. I think they certainly could have assumed that.
So the issue on the confusion is that State Farm offered to pay the fees of Mr. Andrews in his representation of Mr. Pierce, and Mr. Pierce wanted to make sure that State Farm knew that he did not want them.
Well,
there's
one other point. You asked me about omissions. Part of the evidence that our expert testified about was the thing that was not told to Pierce was, first, that you are defending yourself. State Farm is not controlling the matter. And secondly, that you can choose any attorney you please. The testimony is that had that disclosure been made, that Pierce and Andrews might have had what our expert called a foot race to find a real lawyer to take over the defense of the case. So what you have is the insured is told, we will defend you, and then a letter is sent to Andrews saying, send us your bills.
Did Pierce ever notify the insurance company that he was dissatisfied with the representation he was getting from Andrews?
He testified he made numerous telephone calls back up to State Farm's office in an attempt to get someone to rectify his concerns about Andrews' inactivity and never could get anyone to respond to him other than to say you'll have to call Mr. Andrews or you'll have to go back to your adjuster, Miss Uncle.
Didn't Pierce pick Andrews?
Initially he did, back before the investigation.
If he hired Andrews, couldn't he fire him and get another lawyer?
Ultimately, when he became so frustrated, he obviously did that. But Pierce's testimony is that during the time after he got these letters saying, we are defending you, he felt like that State Farm was controlling the defense, and he had to go back to the horse's mouth, so to speak, to get any permission to do anything. And it was for those many months that confusion allowed, in effect, no one to be in control.
Again, that's where I have some confusion. What specifically is in the record about what he specifically told State Farm regarding his position that he was inadequately represented by counsel by Andrew?
Well, his testimony again is that he called numerous times
and said what?
And said that he couldn't get a hold of Andrews and that he wanted to know what State Farm was going to do to defend him. And from that, I believe the jury believed, and the testimony certainly is sufficient for them to have believed, that Pierce was confused that State Farm, in effect, was controlling what he could and couldn't do with reference to Andrews. And the most important point is that Andrews was the only lawyer they were willing to pay the fees on. And Andrews was out to lunch, to say the very least. Wasn't returning calls to Pierce, wasn't sending reports or any sort of status inputs to State Farm or anything.
Did Andrews represent Mr. Pierce in a criminal case?
For a while he did, yes, sir.
Did Did he represent him at the time that he pleaded nolo contendere?
No, I don't think he did.
He had other counsel?
I think he had other counsel at that time.
Did he give notice to State Farm when he fired Andrews and hired another counsel in the civil case?
Did Pierce?
Yes.
No, ma'am. He surely did not. Now, turning to the claim that State Farm is immune, if you look at what they say the reason they can have no tort liability to Pierce is because they had no coverage. They base that on two cases, the Hernandez case and the Garcia 1 opinion. Now, if you go look at Hernandez, it adopts the judgment rule, and the only thing it says about the insurance policy is, in the present case, now I quote here, in the present case, the insurance policy is relevant only in that it is the source of Great American's duty to use care in the defense of Hernandez for any judgment for any amount. Therefore, the entire basis for their claim that an insurance company is immune if it has no coverage, no matter what wrongs it engages in, is based on a misreading of this court's 1971 opinion in Hernandez. Then secondly, it misreads Garcia and says Garcia is a Stiers case or a failure to defend case, and therefore because there's no coverage, the plaintiff loses that case. And it would have this court say that if there's no coverage, the plaintiff loses any case. Once again, we're immune. Once you get past our contractual liabilities, we become immune from the DTPA, from any form of other tort liability we might have for any conduct we engaged in. Now, I would ask you this question. Taking that to its most illogical conclusion, if Mr. Pierce had gone to State Farm's offices in Dallas to sit down to discuss this defense, which probably would have been a good idea at some point, and while on the premises was mauled by the pet lion that kept in their office there, would they then be standing here and say, well, since he had no coverage, we as tortfeasors have no liability? Now, that's an extreme example, but that's exactly my point. This liability flows from what they did and how they did it and how they confused their insured about who was in charge, ultimately leading to the conclusion by the jury that virtually no one was in charge.
Did it make any difference? Wasn't he going to be convicted under almost any set of circumstances? And how is it consistent with finding that they don't have any coverage?
Firstly, Mr. Pierce protested throughout the entire proceeding that he was not guilty of any of these acts and that it was his frustration with the inability to get State Farm to provide him any answers about how he could defend himself that led to his decision to give up.
But he agreed to a judgment.
He agreed to a judgment. That's correct. The jury heard all about that, and I'm sure reached its conclusions about how guilty or not guilty he was. My point is that the causation in this case is Pierce was subjected to making that hard decision, his testimony is, because he couldn't get any relief at all from an insurance company that promised him it was going to give him relief. And so, much like a legal malpractice case...
What difference does that make if you're still going to lose?
Well, Pierce said he was not going to lose.
How could he not lose if there was no coverage, which meant that he did it, doesn't it?
Well, no, I don't think it means he did.
Well, then there would have been a coverage.
No, that's not the point. The point is you can harm an insured even when he has no coverage, is my point. And Pierce has testified that he would prevail in the underlying case, and an expert has testified that at the very least the damages could have been substantially reduced from what they were in the agreed judgment.
What difference would that make?
Well, it would have been
only been $3 million instead of $6 million, or $1 million.
Well, I suppose that's a fact question for the jury.
What is the legal difference? Not what could the jury believe about it, but if that's what's going to happen to you, what difference does it make that they didn't tell him that he should get another lawyer or that Matthews wasn't doing it right or whatever?
Well, I think it comes down to the question of whether the end result can then be used to justify the wrongdoing that has led to that end result. And what you're stating in the form of the question is, in fact, most of their presentation here is, Mr. Pierce is an evil person, he's an abuser, and he deserves no respect or consideration. And yet it was the jury found their misconduct and their confusion over his right to have counsel, which has always been considered to be a precious right in the court of right, that led to that very occurrence that's given him that very stigma. Now, State Farm made these very arguments factually to the jury that Mr. Pierce was not going to be able to pay a $6 million judgment, and he was not going to be able to pay a $2 million judgment. And so what difference does it make? Well, but Pierce's testimony was that he would prevail. Pierce also had testimony that he would, if this judgment had not been entered and he hadn't been required to throw in the towel, that he would have had none of the stigma and none of the mental anguish associated with going through months and months of frustration in the face of these serious charges.
How could he avoid the stigma of the criminal?
Well, the same way he could avoid them in the civil case, by having competent counsel to defend him. One of the confusions Pierce had was
that State Farm not responsible for the counsel in the criminal proceedings.
That's exactly correct. However, Pierce's testimony was, somehow or another, and I'm not exactly sure how Pierce reached this conclusion, but his testimony was that in his initial meetings with his adjuster, he got the impression that the defense would be both for the civil case and in the criminal case. And I don't know whether there were discussions about the civil case should go to trial first or what caused him that confusion. And I agree it's not a logical conclusion, but that's what his testimony was. And so when State Farm refused, in his opinion, to follow through on their promises to defend him in the civil case, he just assumed that life was not worth living and threw in the towel on both cases. Now, that may not be logical, but that's what the testimony of Pierce was.
It seems to me that the law generally stands for the proposition that one party is relieved of their obligations of performing under a contract in anticipation of another's breach only in the circumstance where it is clear that the other party intends not to comply with the contract. In other words, you're not required to do a fruitless act. If you're clear they're not going to do it, then you don't have to do it. Well, here we have a case where Mr. Pierce is saying, I thought they were going to defend me. I thought they were going to come forward. I thought they were going to do the following things. You have an insurance company out there that is in contact with the attorney Mr. Pierce chose, offers to pay their fees, and in contact with that attorney. The posture of this case comes to us with Mr. Pierce saying, well, I didn't want them to hire Andrews. I didn't know they would hire somebody else. I didn't know that's what they were planning on doing. Is the actions of State Farm so unequivocal, that Mr. Pierce, after the fact, did not need to alert them that he'd hired a different counsel in the civil case, and Mr. Pierce, after the fact, didn't need to let State Farm know that he was going to settle the lawsuit for $6 million, that after the fact, he could sue State Farm for having botched the defense of the case? Is State Farm's act so unequivocal that it's clear from the information that Mr. Pierce didn't have anything further to do except sit back and accept an agreed judgment against himself?
Well, I would argue certainly that it is. Our expert testified that the woefulness of the carrier appointing in these letters Andrews, and then 9 months goes by, no follow-up check, no follow-up on any of the letters or phone calls to try to figure out what's going on with the defense. Now, one of the things that we cannot forget, and I think has been raised, is irrespective of the covenant issue in this case, this judgment, whether it is ever paid or not, there is direct testimony in this record, and the Court of Appeals has cited the court to it, that Pierce suffered consequential losses separate and apart from mental anguish and loss of reputation, apart from whether he would ever have to pay the judgment or not.
But not apart from the charge he pled nolo contendere to. Is that correct? The damages you just discussed are not separate apart from the criminal charges he pled nolo contendere.
No, they certainly are. Yes, he testified to the frustration of the many months of trying to figure out who was going to defend him and what was going to be done in the civil case as well. And, of course, that's all in addition to the testimony that he said on their questions. He said he would have prevailed in the underlying case, and it would have made a difference. He would have been the winner. Now, that question was asked by State Farm, no objection by State Farm. And now they want this court to say, well, even though we injected that evidence into the record, we want you to disregard it. That's the kind of waiver I don't think they can get back.
What was the timing when the no-lo contingency plea ended before the judgment or the plea-dollar judgment?
I'm not exactly sure. I think they were within a matter of a few weeks of each other. I think the criminal case may have been a little bit prior. But I quite frankly, I don't recall.
Are you suggesting that Pierce was worried about paying the judgment when he agreed to a $6 million judgment?
Pierce was worried about defending himself against what he thought to be false allegations in both courts.
That's not my question. When he, you just, I thought, suggested that he wasn't sure whether he was going to have to pay the judgment or not, and I'm wondering if he agreed to a $6 million judgment not knowing he was going to, whether he was going to pay.
No, absolutely not. At the time he agreed to the judgment, he was aware of the covenant to limit the execution. But it was the prior months that he had suffered without any counsel, without any assistance, in anticipation of how he was going to resolve that issue that I was referring to. Now, what it comes down to, in a nutshell, Your Honors, is State Farm says Mr. Pierce is a silly person. His belief that he...
Not silly. He's a convicted child molester. Not silly.
But on the point of liability they have here, they say Mr. Pierce was silly to become confused about what we were doing. They had that factual defense in front of the jury, and the jury rejected it. At its highest level, that is a claim that Mr. Pierce was contributorily negligent in how he read or how he construed what they told him and what they didn't tell him. Contributory negligence is not an affirmative defense to the DTPA.
What was the substance in the underlying criminal case?
I'm not entirely familiar with that. I think it was probation for some term of years and a fine.
Mr. Adams, just one last question. In the exhibits, there appears to be like a Plaintiff's Exhibit 13, which is a June 24, 1991 letter to Ray Andrews from State Farm, which has the first sentence that says, Dear Mr. Andrews, please be advised State Farm has made the decision to defend Ted Pierce. And then there's a lot of white space, and at the bottom of the letter it says, if you have any questions with regard to the above, please feel free to contact. There appears to be a Defendant's Exhibit 10, which is the same day, June 24th, to Ray Andrews by the same person, Pat Omaker, and it starts out with the same letter. The sentence says, please be advised State Farm has made the decision to defend Ted Pierce under a reservation of rights, period, and then goes on in a series of coverage questions that it poses.
Yes,
where did this Plaintiff's Exhibit 13 come from, and where's this Defendant's Exhibit 10? Can you explain what this is?
Plaintiff tendered a redacted form of that letter to avoid the entire issue being presented to the jury of reservation of rights and what the legal position of the parties were. Later on in the trial, the court just pitched it all in there and said allow them to tell the jury that they were not obligated or they felt they weren't obligated under their policy to indemnify.
You mean the lawyer on behalf of Ms. Gandy wanted to tender a letter that said they had made the decision to defend Ted Pierce without the issue of under reservation right?
When the trial first began, we took the position that the jury shouldn't be informed in passing on the tort case about the lack of any coverage. So, yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I would ask that the court take a look at page 23 of the reply brief for petitioners, through 25. I think that's really important. The court has heard a number of things regarding what Pierce said, who he talked to at State Farm that are just simply not correct. Ted Pierce could have called State Farm. State Farm has absolutely no record that he ever did. When cross-examined, Ted Pierce said he didn't know when he talked to him. But he said he did know one thing, that he'd taken notes, and he destroyed the notes. Now, there is a legal presumption under this text state that as a matter of law, one who has documents in his control pertinent to an issue and destroys them, the presumption is that those documents would have been to the contrary of the position that he took. Also in this case, in terms of what happened, I think it's important for the court to see the evolution of this theory. Because Ted Pierce, when this case started out, he hired Andrews. He knew that he had a drinking problem, but he was one of his cronies. He'd used him on the criminal case, had him hired on the divorce case. He knew what he could do. He knew that he was a criminal lawyer. The discovery was screwed up. The ox was in the ditch before State Farm ever offered to defend. They'd already screwed up the discovery back in April. State Farm's first offer of defense comes in June. Ironically enough, the day after State Farm sends the letter, Mr. Browning, with the plaintiff's firm, is contacted by one Howard Pattison, attorney number two for Pierce, who had an equally checkered background, some 15 or more grievances against him. He comes in, he tells him, I'm probably going to substitute in for Andrews. And they talk about the case. They talk about the discovery screw-ups. Pierce is told before the reservations come, the discovery screwed up. But he doesn't do anything. Nothing. He waits until sanctions are imposed in August. He says, well, I couldn't do anything constructive because I couldn't get my file from Mr. Andrews. He hires and fires in this case at will. This is a charade that is being perpetuated on this court to say that Ted Pierce didn't know exactly what he was doing. He even consulted the DA in the county where he lived about the fact that Andrews was screwing the case up. No hesitation. And no, Justice Enoch, he never made any attempt to contact State Farm. State Farm asked for them to report to them if there was anything important. They didn't. They didn't talk to him in September when they started doing a setup deal. They didn't talk to him in October or November as they were effectuating that deal. They didn't even talk to him once the judgment, the setup judgment, agreed judgment, which has all sorts of recitations of things that happen to make it look sanctify it. And in fact, they're totally untrue, duping the trial judge in that case and making him look bad as well. But no, we didn't even hear about that. In fact, Mr. Holman, once we finally get wind that something's going on with State Farm, calls up Mr. Pattison and he says, has there been a judgment entered in this case? And Pattison, in his wonderful, inimitable style, says, well, I'm not sure where it is. I can't find my file. I don't know. Lied. He lied about it. The theory from day one, according to everyone, Ted Pierce said there was a denial of defense, a denial of coverage. And if this court will take a look at the covenant not to execute in the assignment, I believe that's Exhibit 41. I don't have the right exhibit here. The court, that should be in the briefs. What that assignment says is there was a denial and a refusal to defend, not mismanagement defense, nothing with a problem with E. Ray Andrews, no indication of confusion about Ted Pierce, but in fact there was a denial. Ted Pierce, according to Howard Pattison, testified that he'd been told that there was a denial letter. So, the whole setup is done based upon the presumption that State Farm just flat denied it. Well, what happens? There is a letter sent in the record to Howard Pattison once we find out about the judgment from my law firm. And we tell them, what is going on? Here are two letters attached where we have offered to defend. Offered to defend. And you're saying we refused? All of a sudden, if I may just have a moment to complete this, a letter comes out from the plaintiff's office. And it's asking, where is this letter of denial? Even attaches an affidavit asking for Pierce to put under oath what really happened. And he never signed it. Because what they're telling this court happened is not what happened. No harm, no foul, and the criminal goes free. Thank you.
That concludes the argument, and the first clause the court will take a brief recess.
Guys, okay, right.